Welcome everyone to this One Earth Sangha community webinar. Our guest today is Kriti Kanko. Kriti is environmental scientist at Environmental Defense Fund, Zen teacher and founder of the Boulder Ecodharma Group. The webinar is hosted by Lou Leonard and Kristen Barker and was recorded on February 28, 2016. Note that the first 2 minutes of the webinar were not recorded. Thanks for joining us. We hope you find it useful.
Grandfather, who was a lawyer and left his promising career to join Gandhi's freedom struggle, freedom movement in India. And he went on to become a civil disobedience leader. On four separate occasions, he was imprisoned for a total of 3.5 years. And after India got its independence in 1947, he went on to become leader of a political party, similar to maybe you'd say vice governor of his state, finance minister of his state. And his constant refrain was, we've gotten political freedom, but what about social and economic freedom? And he would just constantly, through his lifestyle, through spiritual leaders he met or political leaders he met, he'd keep asking this question. About how do we bring about more social and economic equality. So I grew up with him around me. And when I tried to emulate him, let's say in my college years back in India, I found myself to be very, very bitter, very isolated. There was just a lot of othering. There was a lot of isolated, and I was very isolated, very arrogant. And I think a lot of people can identify with that feeling. I was also looking back very needy, and things were black and white for me. Either I was right or I was wrong. And by the time I came to US to do my PhD, I actually fell into deep depression. So what I didn't know at the time was how my grandfather supported his activism. Years later, going through his biography, I found that he had a regular yoga practice. He was extremely disciplined, got up at 4 or 5 in the morning every day of his life, and so on, right? So you get a sense. And we'll hopefully come back to this later in our conversation, of how I think a lot of other activists can find themselves becoming very bitter. You might not identify as an activist, but we all know that feeling. So jump on to a second phase of my life. I came here, I'm trying to finish my PhD, trying to do a good job there, but also trying to deal with this underlying depression. I started sitting. I started meditation with my teacher, Kurt Spellmeyer at Rutgers. And within a few weeks, I just found myself laughing. It was just this genuine, carefree laughter. I still remember when I first laughed after many months, or it sounded like, seemed like years. I soon reached a point where I was doing 5 7-day retreats a year, sitting every morning, every evening. And I reached a point where I could sit without moving a muscle for 2-3 hours, right? And I could sit and drop into what is called in Zen tradition, mushin. And what you also learn in Zen practice, that teachers give you what are called koans. These are teaching tools which have something inherently contradictory and complex built into them, and you have to live through, really, with your whole heart and mind, live through that contradiction. And then you get training to drop again and again and again into what you can only call groundless, right? boundless groundlessness, or people call it emptiness, zero-ness. And I think, well, again, we could come back to this, but just this ability to live with contradiction again and again is now proving to be very helpful. The other thing that I want to share is, you know, so you can get very good at falling into or living in that emptiness. There is another aspect of the training as it goes in Zen tradition that is important here. So one summer at the peak of my practice, my mother visited us from India. And she might have stayed for about a month and a half. And in those days, my schedule was just packed with being a PhD student and being a Zen student. I wouldn't create any time for my family and friends. It was like I was holier than thou. So I would spend all my time sitting or working. So I wouldn't create time what is needed to create a community, a family, friends. When my mother was leaving, we dropped her at the airport. My husband and I are coming back, and my tears just wouldn't stop rolling. I couldn't understand it. I was stunned. I was totally stunned. Maybe I should have felt relief. Maybe I can live my life, you know, no mom to nag me. But I was stunned that my tears wouldn't just stop falling. And I went straight to my teacher and I said, you know, I feel sad. And he actually said, good. Like, what? He said, this is brokenheartedness. This is interconnectedness. I think I didn't know at the time how crucial it is that we don't just enter Mushin, what we call zero-ness or emptiness, but also try to look from within that emptiness, what is the relationship between what I called I, Kriti, and you, or my mother at the time, right? That relationship is crucial. Hopefully we'll come back to this later. So where am I now? As Christian said, work for Environmental Defense Fund. And I think what I'm learning here is, you know, a mother can love her infant baby with all her heart and mind, but even she needs to learn skills on how to actually change the diaper, or what to do when the baby gets sick, what to do when there is a breathing tube inserted. I think what I'm learning now is how to identify and work with socioeconomic, political, societal levers, which can take us where we need to be. And I'm going to end with sharing of an image. Hopefully you can see this. I think the only reason these are some images from areas where I now work in India with very, very small scale farmers. And I think the only reason I'm able to keep coming back to this reality of how farming is affecting climate and how climate is affecting farming is because of my practice and coming back to and being okay with both brokenheartedness and the immense complexity and contradiction of the situation we are in. So with that, I'm going to hand it back to Kristen. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, Kriti. And it's wonderful to have your sharing. with us, and I want to invite Lou into the conversation. Lou, would you like to say anything before we get started on the panel discussion?
Well, only just how excited I am to be having this conversation with you, Kriti, and Kristen, and yeah, let's get to it.
Let's talk about this in a moment-to-moment experience. I'm interested if the two of you can speak to how your spiritual practice informs your day-to-day participation in your secular activity, and vice versa. How does that secular activity come to the cushion for you, come to your walking meditation? So maybe you can start out just speaking to that moment-to-moment experience.
For me, I think these two things are really intimately connected. I still consider myself very new to the practice of meditation and the Dharma. And 6 years ago, when I started on this path, it really was from the experience of really bottoming out and burning out as an environmentalist, as an activist working within civil society, but also as, you know, somebody who has had the issues of kind of the fate of our world and social and ecological justice as part of my experience for basically my whole adult life. And reaching a point in 2010, after I'd been with World Wildlife Fund for about 2 years, and had been working on trying to help get a climate law enacted in this first couple of years of the current Obama administration, and the experience of having basically been part of the process that did not lead to an outcome in Copenhagen that people felt good about, that resulted in kind of the withdrawal of the climate legislation in the Senate after it was passed in the House, and amid very high expectations for what we thought could be achieved in the United States during that time. I felt annihilated. I felt entirely undone by it, and the strategies that I'd been using to keep myself engaged in the in the movement and staying motivated kind of supported were not working for me anymore. And those strategies were very individual strategies. They were about setting up goals for myself. They were about a sense of my own accomplishments. They were around a fear of failure and a need to be very self-critical. So I think, so the doorway for me into the Dharma and into meditation practice was really the experience of being unable to maintain my my energy and engagement as an activist with the strategies that I'd had before. So for that reason, these things, remain very connected for me. They're not always, they don't always stay connected in the moment. A lot of the things that I just mentioned that I do, self-judgment, kind of fear of failure, those things aren't directly related to the movement. They present more as, kind of my individual challenges, but they're constantly presenting in a day-to-day way, within my experience of being an activist.
So isn't it interesting, Lou, I've heard you say these things before, but I just want to draw a parallel. Your experience of sort of feeling annihilated and me feeling depressed trying to emulate my grandfather, right? I mean, I was much younger when I was in college, but I think all of us have gone through that. I can't think of moment-to-moment examples right now, but what I can tell you, Kristen, that I am nowhere close to that bitter and isolated. I think it is both the practice and the community, right? I think, Lou, and you formed One Earth Sangha because you thought community was important. And for me, I came to the community, came to realize the community aspect of our eco-dharma activities much later, it didn't come along with practice. But both those things together just really keep me, even though things have actually only gotten worse, they haven't gotten better since late 1990s when I was extremely bitter and depressed. I can tell you that I can get up from meditation and wanting to dance and joy. Yes, the heart breaks when I'm with farmers in India, you know, the kind of farmers we work with, the areas where we work with, that's the most drought-prone area in India. The suicide rate among farmers are among the highest. And my heart breaks. And I think the ability to hold the heartbreak comes from my practice. And then not being bitter, and then in spite of all that, getting up from meditation and wanting to break out in a joyous dance, I don't think that could have come without practice. And I wouldn't have stayed up with this job, with this task of always coming back to the climate reality we are in and the reality of these farmers without that practice. I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I think you're hitting on one of the things that I wanted us to talk a little bit more about, which is, you know, there's a lot of discussion right now about mindfulness at work, about people bringing their practice to their professional lives or their relationship lives, their community lives, but bringing it in a way that reduces reactivity, that creates that space for, you know, looking at what's operating and asking the question, you know, how can I respond most skillfully? And so I think all of us who are engaged in spiritual practice in a lay life have that opportunity to do that piece of integration. But I wonder what it is about doing climate work in particular. Is there something special about the working on ecological crises in a day-to-day way that demands, that creates the need for this practice? I wonder if either of you could speak to that.
Sure. I think for me, it goes back to some of what Kriti was saying about that brokenheartedness and the accessing joy. Separate from sort of the ecological crisis for a minute, one of the places where my practice has served me best is when I've been able to access that bigger sense of interconnection and self that goes beyond the little self that feels, you know, judged and judges himself, that feels too little for the problem. And being, what I've found is that being in the day-to-day throes of working on a huge, you know, in some ways the ultimate interconnection challenge of an ecosystem of life in crisis, it allows me to tap into that sense of bigger self and interconnection that then is a real doorway to love and joy and a more sustainable sense of energy in the work. And you know, the truth of interconnection, you know, kind of slaps you in the face when you're working on climate change every day. You know, it's not something that is theoretical or allegorical. It is the reality of biology and physics and the truth of what you see when you're, you know, traveling in other countries or just experiencing life here in the United States. This is something that both for better and for worse connects all of us. And for that reason, it is a constant reminder of both the joys and the sorrows of that interconnection.
Thank you, Lou. That's wonderful. And I'm also thinking back about conversation we had a little while ago. I think because climate change is such a complex problem, as you just said, and if you start arguing with someone who's a climate skeptic, for example, people sort of pick up on individual examples and say, oh, this record, blah, this record. just being able to wrap your head around just the science part of climate change is complex, right? To say, well, it's just temperature increasing, but why is it causing storms? And why is it causing, yes, I can understand the sea ice melting, but what does it have to do with typhoons? That connection in itself is not straightforward and simple. So the whole thing is just the causes are complex, potential solutions are complex, how we behave as human beings in communities, our psychological, spiritual selves, that's complex. And I think we require to be able to face this problem again and again is our ability to live with the complexity of it all. And the solution would come, as Lou was pointing towards, by appreciating our interconnections, right? So it's a complex problem that requires a solution that comes from our interconnectedness. So it's like you need to appreciate interconnectedness at all levels, interconnectedness problems, how the problem of climate relates to social justice, and then, the solution will also come from, on a very micro level, Lou, Kristen, Krippi, Angel Kyodo Williams, David Lloyd, Bhikkhu Bodhi, everyone coming together and feeling together and approaching this together, at the same time looking at levers at many different places, and then something will evolve. So I feel that the way we can separate out problems in other realms, right? What was the example you were giving, Lou, yesterday? Were we talking about Lockheed Martin? Could you say that? Right, the way we work with some other profession, right? The way we work our practice into some other profession is qualitatively different from this.
Right, where if the, and we, sort of, I guess we could pick on almost any, individual, company or institution with a narrow focus, right, to either achieve, build more and sell more widgets, or grow more market share, or those sorts of things. I mean, it's possible you can do that within a more narrow sense of both how connected we are, but also how much we need each other. But I think with this challenge, with something that is so, requires so much of all of us, that you can't pretend that we can succeed, if we're doing it on our own. And I think that this also points to another aspect of the practice that we often hear a lot about, and that is letting go, and the importance of letting go. And for me, almost my entry to the practice was an act of letting go, kind of letting go of the sense that I could do it all as myself, or that if I just held myself to high enough standards, I could make a difference. I could really, kind of have a real impact. And I think that because of the complexity that you're speaking to, Kriti, and also just the bigness of this and the need for so many different people with so many different backgrounds and experiences that no one person could ever hold, that it is a forced letting go. And it's and one of my experience of that letting go has been both scary, but also like really great, and there's a lot of joy when you put down so much of your own sense of having to do it yourself, and then appreciating all that other people are doing. And given the intergenerational quality of this, like, we're not gonna, all of us who are on this planet right now are not going to be able to do enough to to end our lives saying we did it, right? This is a letting go of multiple lifetimes. I think there's no way around it with this problem. You have to be okay with letting go and noticing what, the joy and the energy and the optimism that can come from that.
Yeah, I'll just chime in with my piece of the particular challenge and opportunity that practicing in the context of climate change. We had session 5 of the Ecosatha training was called The Sickness of Medicine, because this insistence that maybe it just demands that we start to see ourselves as an integrated whole, and that we, it's no longer, you know, Buddhism, and David Loy spoke to this, but Buddhism, and I hear this so much in even the Dharma, a lot of the Dharma talks that we have, just the way that we come from it is, you know, let me be in harmony with my world. Let me come to see reality in such a way that allows me to kind of flow with it so much more than, and that is absolutely essential. That is absolutely the beginning. And I feel like this crisis requires that and more, that we actually relate with others and begin to help all of us see how to get our totally understandable and healthy needs met in a way that actually works for not just this being, but all beings and future beings. And that is so much, you know, there's like now there's a dependency. My path is now interdependent truly with the growing wisdom and compassion of others. And I have to find a way to be okay with that which I cannot control with it as well. So it's an enormous challenge, I feel, that we are right in the heart of. I wanted to bring in, we're doing well on time, but I got a message from Victor, and I wanted to share with you what Victor put in his chat window, which folks can feel free to do. He says, perhaps one of the challenges we face is to see that climate change work is inseparable from the work of pushing back against interconnected systems of oppression. It is not a freestanding issue, but rather an indicator of a larger process that also results in racism, genderism, economic oppression, etc. So I really welcome that comment, Victor, and I wonder if either of you want to comment on that.
It's so well said. It's wonderful, right? He crafted it for us. This is what I was referring to from my point of view on this interconnectedness of problems, and this is such a koan in itself, right? On one hand, we have urgency. I've heard many climate activists say, "Oh, climate change is, you know, and to change is weird." A friend of mine says, "Use climate calamity or climate chaos. Change is like change happens all the time. You know, who cares about change?" That's such an urgent problem, you know, all the other social justice problems that Victor is referring to, you know, we wouldn't have any time to solve them if we don't solve the climate change problem first. However, on the other hand, you know, we know so well, we know it in our bones that these are such deeply intertwined problems that unless we lift the whole metrics up, it's like you lift the whole platform up, you could suppress a symptom, but you're not going to cure the underlying patterns and disease. So, yes.
So we agree 100%. And I think that another a thing that we've seen over the last, say, 10 years or more on the climate movement that is just beginning to change, and I think it's there's more and more acceptance and embrace of this, the interconnectedness of the challenge, the interconnectedness of the causes, the interconnectedness of the movements. But I think part of that is because of a dawning of the truth of those interconnections. But also I think that part of what helped bring that about is sort of the lonely, you know, ineffectiveness of a climate movement that was speaking a lot more to itself than it was speaking to others and the realities that they were feeling in terms of the thing, you know, the sort of really primary and immediate problems that people are facing every day. So I think that it's both true, and it's the only way we're actually going to build the momentum for change that we need is if we actually embrace and lean into those interconnections and bring, you know, be open to conversation with kind of other social movements and others who are coming up, you know, pointing at and coming at the change that needs to happen from somewhat different perspectives, but in a way that if brought together could really advance all of the transformation that needs to happen. I mean, I've seen it just in the sort of, you know, white male, big green movements, although I'm white male and Kriti, you're not, we're both in it, how much those institutions are both changing in their complexion and their leadership, but also in their understanding of the need to open up their strategies and partnerships and approaches to be led by and to co-create with these other actors who have just as much insight and in some cases a lot more power to really bring the change about.
Yes, beautiful. And I think, I'll just say that I heard Tim Wise speaking recently about this, and he's a wonderful speaker on white privilege, and he was talking about really the need to bring in race in particular into these, because a lot of times race is an underlying reason why some of these other issues exist, are allowed to continue. Is because, again, we see at the collective level a sense of self and other. And so that the oppression is enabled. And so we get, water poisoning in the Native American reservation, in the reservation communities and in Flint. These are the kind of things, these are the fulcrums around which, environment ends up being a fulcrum around which that oppression expresses itself. So, yeah, thank you so much for that, Victor. And I think we have time for a couple more questions. So we've talked a little bit about community. Both of you have brought it up before, but I want to go a little bit deeper into that. So I'm wondering how this integration of the secular and the sacred challenges Sangha, and what are the fruits of that challenge, if you know what I mean. So a lot of us, go to Sanghas on a regular basis. Some of us don't have access to Sangha. There are folks who are kind of practicing on their own because they don't have a good Sangha to connect with. So both of those, even in that, there's a sense of separation. And I think even when we come together, whether it's going on retreats or going to weekly meetings, how does this issue for you intersect with the experience of Sangha?
So can I start, Lou? Yeah. As I was saying, my foray into Sangha, my Sangha in New Jersey, was because of my personal depression. And I think a lot of people come to Dharma for that reason. And there is a very strong vertical connection, especially in Zen tradition, of student with the teacher, right? So I call that a vertical relationship. So number one, we don't bring collective issues in general. It's changing slowly, which is so heartening. But we don't bring collective problems, collective delusions, to our sanghas. And number two, the relationship is vertical with the teacher or the leadership and the student. What this problem calls for is, one, we bring our collective delusions and collective problems to sanghas, and then to deal with it, it's going to take collective wisdom. It's going to take a lot of horizontal relationships between sangha members, them hearing out each other, them understanding what are the levers in our local community, right? So, I go to India a lot to work with the farmers to look at scientific solutions, scientific technological levers to the problems they are facing. But I think both there in India and here, where we are trying to build our Eco Dharma Sangha, I always find myself saying, if we have to transform the way we are dealing with these problems and go on the other side, we need a lot more local sanghas empowered horizontally. We don't have time for everyone to get their deep enlightenment experience and then deal with it. Right? And I think it's a huge challenge. And what we are doing here today, and the whole, the creation of One Earth Sangha is like creating that forum. I think it's one of the first ones to do that on this large scale. You know, we need to talk about it, right? Bringing these collective large problems to this global One Earth Sangha. And it hasn't been happening enough. Mm-hmm. I'll stop there, Lou, and
I really resonate with a lot of what you said, and I'm really grateful for what you said about One Earth Sangha, this space. I think for me there's three things, and one is the way that community as a tool for opening up myself individually, to experience love and interconnection. It's much easier for me to get there and to be in that, get myself into that space that from there I can, I can be a more effective member of community through community. So through my weekly sitting group, or through longer retreats, or through Dharma Friends, or, through my relationship with Kristen and the way that we're trying to, stumble through to help create a space for our community, I'm able to do that more when I'm feeling connected and in community. The second thing is what you just said, Kriti, which is how we need, we can only take this on when we're horizontally and, in all directions, connected, and I experienced that truth as part of my sort of global WWF team. I just came back. I was in Morocco about 10 days ago now, last week. And being able to, in the experience of that community, put down my need to be the leader of the U.S. climate program, and instead be part of this global team that's led by a South African woman who is a anti-apartheid veteran, and where the adaptation and resilience work is being led by a Nepalese guy who has that actual experience of living on the edge of climate vulnerability in a very tangible way. Being able to sort of experience that way of trying to engage the problem through a community is super important. But then I said the third thing about my experience of trying to work this specific issue of climate into some of the community spaces that we have as part of the mindfulness Dharma community. It's just been hard because in my experience being part of an insight tradition, in my own experience of coming to the Dharma was about my individual pain. And for that reason, a lot of that is the same as you said, Kriti, for lots of us. And so when you bring in this bigger collective pain into those spaces that people are really getting a lot out of for their individual, to deal with their individual suffering, a lot of times it's not welcome. Not in a way that's totally understandable. It's not something that people first think of those spaces as being made for. So I've run into a lot of challenges as we try to bring this more fully into those collective spaces.
I think, I want to respond to that, Kristen. So there are two things. I think the communities, I think I've said this to you, both of you, before, that we don't need just eco-sattva individuals. We need eco-sattva communities. And my guess is, just having gone through the experience of doing Eco Dharma Sangha in Boulder, our sitting communities, where we are offered deep sitting, it might be daily, weekly, monthly, or yearly meditation practice, or long retreats, it's going to overlap just a little bit. Can you see my Venn diagram? It's going to overlap, but it might not fully align with our eco-sattva community that we are trying to bring, right? So I think we'll have to accept that. Having said that, the eco-sattva community, the eco-dharma community that we have built in Boulder over the last 2.5 years, I think that has been incredible. You know, the friends I have made in Boulder, we might meet twice in a month or once in a month, but I feel like I can rest and surrender in that community. You were talking about surrender earlier, Lou. It's like I also get so haywire, you know, working with the farmers. I have to get the data right. I have to publish the numbers soon. And this needs to inform the policy. And it can be just like, oh, and I can come back to the community and I can let go of my anxiety in a very different way as compared to how my anxiety is handled in a deep meditation retreat. They are both important. I don't think I could be just a climate scientist, activist, advocate, and a Dharma practitioner, right? There is a deep relationship between them. Practice helps me deal with brokenheartedness, face brokenheartedness. And my work helps me actualize the compassion that arises in deep meditation. However, if it was just those two things, I wouldn't keep going. I need the community because I'm a human being, right? My psychological self needs support of the community. So we probably went on a little bit of a tangent, Kristen, but I wanted to bring up this. Yeah, I wanted to say those two things.
Yeah. I think what you're speaking to in part is the sense of that, you know, and I feel this so much for myself, the sense of how much the Dharma has to offer to us in understanding where ecological crises come from, how, you know, using some very, very Buddhist kind of methodologies for understanding causes and condition without blame, without making good and evil, without making right and wrong. And then so to understand this is how we got here and to have that understanding with compassion and accountability, right? And then how do we meet this? How do we meet this incredible challenge and stay present to it, not check out in all the various ways available to us in the modern world? And then the recognition that so many of us cannot check out of that, are completely bound, our bodies, our physical bodies are bound up in climate crisis in the way that I myself am not, but so many of us around the world are. And then how do we respond skillfully? How do we come together? What is the action that all of us can take? So I think there's this sense of there's so much to offer here. And so we found One Earth Sangha and we come together in Ecosattva Sanghas. And we kind of want to spread the gospel, right? I just want to name that, right? Like we want to share, like with everybody, you know, this is the bomb, right? Like this is what I'm saying. You know? And I think what you're speaking to, Kriti, is also that there's something about appreciating the connections that we do have. And letting those serve us, even as we want to understandably help heal the world through the insights that we've had. So there's something of a balance there, I think. Very good. So let's start the breakout sessions. And the inquiry that we're inviting you all to explore is, you know, very much along the lines. I mean, in some ways you can share your impressions from this conversation and the topic at hand, but the specific inquiry you can go into is, what is your experience of integrating spiritual practice and participation in secular activism? What does that look like in your life? How does it happen on a day-to-day basis? How does your activity in the world, whatever it is, and your action on climate, whatever that is, how is it supported by your spiritual practice, and how is your spiritual practice informed by that? And then this piece about community, how does the community piece support or not support that integration? So we'll invite you all to explore that. And look at that, there you are. Go ahead, Deborah, of your enthusiasm. Go ahead, what's your question?
Well, I just wanted to comment on the discussion we had on the breakout session.
Please.
I only spoke with one woman. She lives in Saskatchewan, and I didn't get her name, so I'm sorry about that. She lives in the middle of an area where people are not admitting to climate change and finding that a very huge and a huge block, but she is involved with the Sangha, although she's a new participant, and she is very grateful to the Sangha for providing the support and the safe space where she can talk more about climate change and what that means. I live in Massachusetts, although I'm calling in from Eugene, Oregon. That's because we're moving to co-housing in Eugene. In Massachusetts, where I live, there's a very informed community of people dealing with climate change and sea level rise, and I'm very engaged with them, but not as a Sangha member. Because like the comments, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to tune in earlier. Like the earlier comments, our Sangha is vertically organized rather than horizontally organized, and it is more involved in internal pain, not an individual pain, rather than collective pain. So we don't really have an eco Sangha. I see the role of the One Earth Sangha as being able to bring together individuals and sanghas that are more involved horizontally and more involved in action in order to coordinate local activities, because climate change is really, in my opinion, dealt with on the ground at the place where you are. And that's what I wanted to contribute to this discussion.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Deborah. And Kriti, you're muted, but I invite either you or Lou to chime in on what Deborah's offered here.
Right. So, well, first of all, it's just such an important point, Deborah. I will speak about Ecodharma Sangha, but I also want to say that when we are in communities where people are not ready to accept or are not willing to hear the word climate change because it makes them think about Al Gore, it is still possible to form a community and feel nourished by it. And what do I mean by that? There was a time I was doing a course in politics from Eagleton Institute of Politics, and we regularly met with people who were self-identified as Republicans. I don't have time to go into all the details, but it was really not possible in that group to have discussions about climate change. We just had to use different words and connect with what do they care about, what breaks their heart, right? It doesn't have to be monarch butterflies disappearing due to climate change, but just the fact that monarch butterflies are disappearing. So I know it's hard, you know, on one hand, we know loud and clear what climate change is doing. On the other hand, there might be space for what we call skillful speech, you know, skillful interactions. Okay, so I'll stop there. And then the second part about Ecodharma Sangha here, my core or roots and community is not always my eco-sattva or eco-dharma community. What we did in Boulder here was get together with people from different traditions within Buddhism, and then now not even within Buddhism, but meeting with people from other traditions and see, you know, who cares. And Kristen, we were talking about this yesterday. In the end, it doesn't matter, you know, which tradition people really come from. We don't have to necessarily find eco-Buddhists at some level, right? We are informed by our practice and tradition, and that's wonderful. But if someone else is inspired by the phrase, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, how does it matter? How does it matter? So our community doesn't have to completely intersect and overlap with our Dharma community, which is helping us practice and sit deeply.
Great. Yeah. Lou, did you want to add anything to that or have your own answer to Deborah's question?
I don't have very much to add, although Deborah hitting on a couple of really important things, both about how we talk to each other, whether we're in the same community or not, about this challenge, and not being limited to having to be right about the climate change question, right, as a political question. I think Kriti's point about really listening and speaking from your own heart about what it is that really kind of breaks your heart about what's happening in our world. And from that perspective, it's less about winning a debate, and it's just about speaking from our own heartbreak or worry or love, and then that creates space for the other to do the same. So I think that, as a general matter of how to talk through these things, I think is really important. And then building community, you know, in many, many different ways, I think is also something that really resonated for me and what Kriti said.
Great. Thank you so much for your question and your comment, Deborah. Yeah. George, go ahead.
I just thank you for this. And I just wanted to comment that, again, much like Kriti's, if I'm saying that right, Kriti is saying, within the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, we have started a sangha, a virtual sangha within the Plum Village tradition called the Earthholder Sangha. That's a virtual sangha across all sanghas. We now have 158 ambassadors to our sanghas connected to that. And I mention that because I think that a lot of people will have to find it that way too. Within our local sangha in Pittsburgh, we have some people that are interested, and some of them want to stay more on their own path and not get so deeply into social concerns. So I think that's another opportunity, and also we're working across traditions, as was just said. We gathered around the Pope's encyclical, and so we have the Thomas Merton Center helping to form us all together to share from different traditions to that issue. And those were just some of the ways I think we can go about this. It will come slowly. I think one final thing I will say, what we're doing in the Earthholder Sangha is we started something called Beginning Anew, and we're taking a practice that's being used by the monastic community where they're living together and they sometimes clash with each other. So the Beginning Anew is about relationships. So we're having a Beginning Anew practice with Mother Earth. And we're doing this in days of mindfulness surrounding the Beginning Anew. And then you share with another person after some time, you share with each other something in your childhood or someplace in nature that just where you connect. And then the person gets to be Mother Earth. There's like a surrogate thing. So that person sitting across from you represents Mother Earth, and you can share also your pain, you know, what has happened with the earth. And so it's a really interesting cathartic process, and at the end people really get renewed to take some action. So
That is so beautiful. George, I really appreciate your I love the beginning a new practice from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. It is so beautiful in dealing with ruptures in relationship, and I have never thought about bringing it into our relationship with Mother Earth and non-human beings. I mean, the potential I can just feel is like, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for that.
And, one of our Dharma teachers has put a whole day around this, so there is, if we're interested, he's been 30 years with Thich Nhat Hanh, and he has created an outline for sanghas to begin using. So he's doing 5 of them. I'm going to be doing one. So we're starting within our Earthholder Sangha to adopt his day of mindfulness all around this practice.
Yes. Great. Wow, fantastic. Yeah, and I think someone else mentioned, it is on our homepage right now, the Earth Holders first meeting at Deer Park in Southern California. For those in the U.S. and who are anywhere close, see if you can register for that. Seems like it might be a great opportunity. And One Earth Sangha, Lou and I are both going to be there and maybe doing some offering there. So we were delighted to be invited by Brother Fapo. So thank you again, George, for that. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right. So with that, I'm going to wrap up here and just really want to thank you, Kriti, so much for joining us today and bringing your considerable that passion fire that you bring to your work is so wonderful. It's such a great community. Your heart, your dedication is so strong. I feel it in our friendship. I feel the way that it radiates out to the eco sanghas that you participate in, and then to everything you touch. I think you bring such a beautiful care and passion. So thank you.
Thank you so much. This is a beautiful opportunity for me, and my passion comes from being connected to you all. I hope people who could join us today felt this conversation was engaging and meaningful. I do not think that, as I said before, there is any other forum that is, repeatedly bringing us back to these issues of how practice and activism intersect, and in whatever capacity we associate with these two spheres of life. So if that was meaningful, please help make this happen more often. I know just from this one experience how much effort Kristen, especially Kristen, and also Lou put into creating this space. I know there were issues with technology, there always will be, but the fact that we have this community to lean back on, even if, some people might lean on it more because they don't have any local support at all, and some people might less, this is precious. It really is. And if we do not support it financially, we probably will not be able to sustain it or offer things that we do want to offer. And I'm speaking here for Kristen and Lou. So please help make this happen in whatever way you can. I just cannot say enough good things about, the way Kristen is holding this container for us. So thank you once again.
Looking forward to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just to say to everybody, we're working on getting a Bhikkhu Bodhi into a future session, and have some other really great speakers that we're talking to as well to continue these, because we're hearing from people that coming together, and even if they can't make it live, that these sessions are really valuable to us. So I'll do the dedication of merits right after I give Lou a chance to say anything you want to say here, Lou.
Only to add my thanks to you, Kriti, for being with us, and how much I get out of just being in relationship with you, and the joy that Kristen and I get from being able to be in connection with you, and just more broadly to the whole community here on the line, and those that join us at other times. This challenge leads me to feel lonely and alone and small a lot if I'm not careful. And community like this is the place where I feel bigger less alone and more able to stay in it because I'm feeling connected to all of you. So so thank you for coming today and for really, you know, continuing to build this community with us.
Hear. You know, as I was sort of moving around trying to put myself in different breakout sessions to help people out, I could overhear little pieces, and just the genuineness of the way that people are showing up for this issue really is Donna of one form for me. It really is the generosity of spirit that everyone here, we could be doing something else with our time. I know that for everybody else in this call. And so for you to choose to be here and to show up, I am so, so grateful. And may it serve, may it come back to all of us. So I'll close with this dedication. May all places be held sacred. May all beings be cherished. May all injustices of enslavement, oppression, and devaluation of any kind be righted, remedied, and healed. May those captured by hatred be freed to the love that is their birthright. May those bound by fear be released to the safety of understanding. May those weighed down by grief be given over to the joy inherent in being. May those lost in delusion find relief in the path of wisdom. May all wounds to forests, rivers, deserts, oceans, all wounds to Mother Earth be lovingly restored to bountiful health. May all beings everywhere delight in birdsong and blue sky. May all beings abide in peace and well-being, awaken and be free. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. We hope to see you all again. Be well, go well.
You can support the work of One Earth Sangha by going to our webpage, oneearthsangha.org, and looking for Support Our Work on the homepage. Find out about our next event by going to our website, following us on Facebook or Twitter. And thanks so much for your practice. See you soon.